The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Hello, is anybody out there? Anybody? This is Jim Cobb. If you're hearing this, the worst has happened. I've recorded a podcast at the end of the world and will broadcast it on channel PEN every Friday. It's all about the apocalypse, books, movies, TV, how much food and water will you need your bunker, all that kind of stuff.
Excuse me, sir. You're going to have to keep the noise down. You're in a library and you're scaring the kids. The world hasn't ended yet.
Sorry, ma'am.
Shh, you're in the library at the end of the world with host Jim Cobb.
Fridays, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that modern man has never fought.
And every not realized war in our game of the stellar companions. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We've got a little bit of a different type of movie we're going to talk about this week. Yeah, we have been sticking around the late 50s, and again, we are in the late 50s on this one, 1957. But this is not really a monster type movie like we've been covering the last few weeks. You might call it a little bit of a sci-fi movie because it does sort of involve a mad scientist type character. This one sort of falls into a genre on its own. And I equate it at least to one film that came out around this time period. I remember they got a lot of airplay on the Monster Movie Matinee show, and that was Suruku, Beast of the Amazon. This film is very similar to that. We had some other films that we've talked about in the past that dealt with sort of ancient tribes, not really aborigines, but ancient tribes from Mexico and South America and that sort of thing. And this falls into that category. We're talking tonight about The Unknown Terror. Now, in all honesty, this didn't get a whole lot of airplay on my Monster Movie Matinee. I don't remember it playing on Sunrise Theater when I moved to Raleigh and some of the other monster venues they had out of Raleigh. I do remember it a couple of times in New York, in upstate New York, when I used to watch Baron DeMone's show or also Dr. E. Nick Witte on Monster Movie Matinee. So it got a little bit of airplay. It wasn't a real popular film. And, you know, as far as its theatrical release, it did okay. It was sort of a so-so release. It was part of a package deal that was made by the director who also helped produce, Charles Marquis Warner. He made a deal with several big studios for some of the films that he directed and produced. This was one of them, and it was packaged in. This one was packaged in with a deal he had scored with 20th Century Fox. In fact, when this film was released in August of 1957, it was on a double feature bill with a film called Back from the Dead, one that really didn't get much airplay on TV at all. We may talk about it here on the podcast down the road. But one that we just mentioned, Suruku, we will definitely, we have that on the schedule for the near future as a film that we're going to be talking about from this time period. A lot of people sort of wonder, the ones who've seen it anyway, wonder whether it takes place in Mexico or South America, because you've got sort of an Aztec or type of Mayan type civilization, or a throwback. I shouldn't say really a throwback, but a descendant from one of those types of civilizations. You've got a small village, and we're going to call it Mexico because I think all the signs point that it was probably in Mexico. And looking at other films from this genre that were shot in California, a lot of references are made to remote parts of that country. So we're going to, for argument's sake, say Mexico. But if you know differently, after you hear the podcast here, drop me a line, drop me a line on the fan page and let me know, because right now I've read quite a bit about this and nobody is really sure where this is supposed to take place. I don't think it really matters. I think all that matters is that you're dealing with a culture that has superstitions and legends unlike ours. And that's what makes this film a little interesting. Again, it's not a very powerful film. but I'm not going to call it a bad film either. I'm going to, you know, I'll leave this to you after, at the end of the podcast, what you think about it as we get into the storyline. Now, it's got a competent cast, as a lot of these films do. And I've got to say that Charles did a good job putting this this group together. And let's start with our lead. Our basically our lead male is John Howard. And John, a very, very active actor. He did a lot for many, many years on film and television. Now, you are going to see a lot of actors that you are going to recognize from old Westerns and some of the early TV Westerns and that sort of thing. Now, John, though, is probably one of the exceptions to the rule. He is definitely the actor in this bunch that probably was more successful than the others. He was in Lost Horizon. He played sort of the weird brother of one of the lead characters. George was his name. And I don't know what adjective to use for that character, but he was a character a lot of people think of when they think of Lost Horizon. He was also in The Philadelphia Story. I mean, he was in some big, big films. And one that if you're a real fan of old cinema and old serials and old franchises, you will remember John Howard as being the title character in the Bulldog Drummond series. And that's probably what most people remember him for, other than Lost Horizon. I always remember him for that because he's such a memorable character in that movie, and it's such a great movie. Now we get to our female lead, and that brings us to Marla Powers. Marla may be the most active actor out of this bunch. I mean, she passed away back in 2007, and she was acting right up until a little less than 2 years before she died. She did, Cyrano. She did appearances on TV in the Wild, Wild West, in other movies. I mean, she just worked and worked and worked. And the interesting thing about Marla is, in the early days, in the 50s here, you would see her in sort of a glamour girl type role. And then as she got older, she became a very glamorous older woman. I don't know how I'm trying to be delicate here, but I mean, she was a very, very attractive woman through her latter years in film. And that's what kept her working so much. She had a very nice girl next door type quality, which a lot of these 50 gals did, and a very, very good screen presence. And familiar to a lot of people. When you see her, you might not quite recognize her from this film. This is one of her earlier films. She was only in her early 20s when she made it. But if you go look her up and look at some of her headshots from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you're gonna know who she is, especially from the numerous. I mean, she did so many television appearances. You could fill up a page with them. So you've got two very, very experienced actors kicking this thing off. And then that brings us down to Paul Richards. Paul plays probably, I think, the most interesting character in this whole movie. And he was definitely a favorite character of mine in this. He plays a guy by the name of Pete Morgan. Paul is a very, very good actor. And again, it's a shame his life was cut short by cancer. He was only 50 years old when he died. But he did have a chance to appear on several television shows, a lot of Westerns and things. He had such a unique look. It's really hard to describe. He had a weathered type look to him that really works well in this movie because he plays a character that has been seriously injured on an expedition, and it has left him with this permanent limp in his right leg, and he's sort of bitter about the whole thing because it is obviously they don't have to go into much detail in the film without getting across the message that his life has been very limited since that injury. And all he likes doing is he loves expeditions. And these guys do a lot of cave expeditions, and we're going to get into that just in a second here when we get to the storyline. I mean, but that is the love of his life, and that he felt was sort of taken away from him when he got that injury. It was an injury in a cave during an expedition. We're going to talk a little bit more about his character, Peter Morgan, in just a moment, but I think it is one of the deepest and most interesting characters in this film, and it's one that sort of kept me with this movie because, you know, I'm going to be honest with you folks. There are some small segments in this movie where it can lose you a little bit. I mean, you know, prepare if you haven't seen this and you're going to watch it more for curiosity's sake than anything, invest a little on it. Don't give up on it too soon. But I've got to confess, as a kid, it took me a couple of times around to really, watch this film all the way through the end. Because it a lot of expository stuff in the beginning and a lot of tension leading up to the payoff, which some folks might find a little lacking. And we'll leave that to you when we give you a description here in a moment. Now, our last main character in this is a gal by the name of Mae Wynn, and she plays one of the gals that lives in this small village in Mexico. So, you know, I'm going to say that they're Mayan or of Mayan descent. And she definitely has the look, the dark hair, the dark features, you know, very, very exotic face, a pretty, pretty lady still with us. She is still with us in 90 years old, or I should say 90 years young. And she was in, quite a number of movies. She was in The Caine Mutiny, The Farmer Takes a Wife, The Violent Man. I mean, and she did a ton of TV stuff. But pretty much after 1960, you're not going to see her. That was sort of her last big gig, and that was in a couple of TV series. And that's when she hung up the acting hat and went into retirement. Of course, you know, by then she was only 52 years old, but probably, you know, she'd been in the business for a couple of decades and, good time to wrap it up. Very, very good. And you know, what I really liked about what she did in this film is that even though the character is written a little stereotypical and a little over the top, she didn't play it that way. So she's very believable as this, as this woman from this small town that marries this scientist that comes down there. And I'm just going to mention, you know, again, a couple of the other characters here real quickly. And that is our mad scientist. I should mention him before we get much further. And that is an actor by the name of Gerald Milton. Now, Gerald didn't do very much. This is probably his signature role. He plays a character by the name of Dr. Ramsey, and he is a scientist who has moved to this small village to do specific research on fungi and that sort of thing, spores and all of that, and he needed someplace remote to work. He is a guy, I'll tell you what, when I first saw him as a kid, I had just seen the movie Dr. Cyclops, and he reminds me so much, that character, the character he plays in this, reminds me so much of that character there. You know, he's a little off. When we first meet him in this movie, you know, something's a little off with him. You don't trust him. And he's got those little round glasses, you know, like Dr. Cyclops has. And you just, you have to wonder. And he is married to Mary Wynn's character, Concha. So, there's just something about him that doesn't quite add up. And we'll talk a little more about that in just a second here. And then the last guy we're going to talk about is the guy that plays the character, Lino. And he's building this as Dwayne Gray. And Dwayne, again, another one you'll see from a lot of Westerns and a lot of TV work and also some small budget films. Now, what's the Western connection here? Well, it's probably Charles Marquis Warren, the director, because he made his start and really made his fame directing a lot of Westerns. I mean, that's where he cut his teeth as a director. But then he went on to do some pretty interesting work in the Western genre on early television. He was one of the creators of Rawhide, of the Rawhide series. And then he also, from jumping from the success of that, as the producers were looking at taking the radio program Gunsmoke and converting it to a TV show, he was very instrumental in helping do that. So he really made his name, you know, in television as a Western guy and also some low-budget Western films. You can sort of see that influence in this movie. One of the criticisms that this film got when it got released, and again, sometimes I think, and you know me, folks, sometimes I think film critics get a little bit too critical of some things. But one of the critiques of this, one of the things that the critics didn't like was that they thought the direction was a little simple and all that. I didn't see too many bad issues with the direction on this. So I think as monster movies go and suspense film, and this is really a suspense film as well. You have sort of a monstrous occurrence in here. I think the direction is fine. It's competent. It is a little sluggish in some areas. The ones I was warning you about, that there are going to be a couple of sections that move a little slow, so you've got to watch the pacing. But it's only 77 minutes long. And the one thing that if I will take a little black mark on a movie or whatever like that, it'll be like, okay, the movie is a very short movie. It's, you know, an hour and 17 minutes, and it feels longer, a little bit longer. So not to say it's boring, but again, make a little bit of an investment and see it through, and you'll get a little bit of a payoff at the end. So let's get into the storyline so that you guys can decide about the Unknown Terror. Well, it begins with you've got a fellow who mysteriously disappears, and we see it right in the very beginning. In fact, before the opening credits, you can tell it's somebody in a cave, you know, a spelunker in a cave, but more than just as a hobby. This, you know, you could tell this guy's probably an archaeologist, a geologist, or something. And you're seeing it, you know, from our point of view, looking at him, he sees something horrifying. And all of a sudden, the screen goes to black. So, you know, something bad has happened to this guy. Then you go into your opening credits. And then that takes us to this get-together at the home of our lead character, played by John Howard. And he's playing a guy by the name of Dan Matthews. He and his wife, Gina Matthews. And we find out that Gina is the sister of the guy that we saw in the beginning of the film. And we you know, who was in this cave. And, you know, met with something bad. They're at a get-together at Dan's home, and this is at the height of the Calypso movement. There's Calypso music is very, very popular at this time of the 70s. This time of the 50s. And so they went ahead and brought in this guy, Sir Lancelot. That's his name, as a musician. He was a very famous Calypso musician. And so you got Sir Lancelot and his band, and they're playing in the background of this, and then he does have an opportunity to play a specific song as part of this movie. That song is the one that gets Dan, thinking that this guy that disappeared, Jim Wheatley, who is Gina's brother, was looking for the legendary Cave of the Dead, and I'm going to say in Mexico. I'm going to say, from everything I could see, the times I've seen this movie, it had tie-ins with the Mayan culture. That's just the way it's presented to me. So we're going to call it Mayan and put it in Mexico. And that's what Jim Wheatley was looking for, was this infamous Cave of the Dead. Now we find out, and this is all explained to us in the beginning of the film, that the Cave of the Dead in this culture, in this particular tribe, is considered the entrance to purgatory. Now that's different than the entrance to hell, because the true nature of purgatory in a lot of cultures is that, yeah, you can go there, but you have a chance of getting back out. Your soul can be released from there. There's a reincarnation type thing. But according to the song that Sir Lancelot sings, yes, you can go into this Cave of the Dead, but after you've suffered some, then you have the opportunity of coming back out and redeeming yourself. So that figures into this a little bit, because, you know, the legend helps us understand a little bit why this character, Jim Wheatley, who, again, we only see him in the very beginning of this movie. I mean, he's in there for less than 5 minutes, why he is so obsessed with finding this Cave of the Dead. Well, Dan, after hearing this song, is convinced that this tribe knows something about where Jim Wheatley was at, and he needs them to find this Cave of the Dead so that he can take an expedition in there and find this guy, because he's been missing for quite a while. And Gina is going to go down there with him. He has he's got the cooperation of a guy who lives in that village, who told him you know, this cave is near my village. His name is Raul. And Raul has promised that he would go with them down there and sort of, you know, set them up in the village so that they can find this cave and go look for Jim. Now, while this party is going on, this is when we're introduced to Peter Morgan. And the, we you know immediately when Pete shows up that he is a bitter guy. He is a bitter guy. They make sure you see that he has a limp. This may be a little minor criticism of what Charles does in the direction. We know he's limping, but you don't need a close-up to sort of hammer it in. And a lot of directors do this in these movies. But, you know, they hammer in, hey, by the way, look, he's got a limp. He's got a limp. You know, almost point, you know, draw an arrow to it. I think it would have been better if he just let it go. I think that Paul Richards, the actor, does very, very well at making this believable. It's not over the top. It's not cheesy. And you almost believe that, man, maybe they hired an actor who really, you know, has a leg that has been severely hurt and it will always cause this person to limp. It's that believable. But the underlying anger and bitterness that Paul brings to this character is really good. I think it's one of the high points of the movie is this guy's character because he is definitely bitter. He is there to convince Dan to take him on this expedition. And he's insistent. He's insistent. You know, now he's met with Gina first. She meets him at the door. They all go back together. There's an implied sort of romantic triangle that happened. But, you know, unlike a lot of the movies we've talked about in the past few weeks, this triangle took place in the past because then Gina went on and married Dan. And we find out that Dan and Peter, you know, sort of went on expeditions together. They were partners in expeditions. And Peter, we find out, was injured. This is how he injured. He injured his leg in a cave-in when they were in a cave-in. He saved Dan's life at the expense of losing the, you know, partial use of his leg. So, you know, there's this underlying thing, and he doesn't even have to say it, but you know that he is going to, you know, he wants not only to redeem himself, to prove that he can go on this expedition and be all right. And Dan, and there's a little bit more of an element to it in that, hey, Dan, you know, I saved your life, so you really sort of owe me for this one. And again, that's not done with lines. It's all done with the acting. So it's a very nice job that Charles does directing in this, because that is one of the more engaging parts of the beginning part of this film. So they're off and running. The four of them are off and running. Raul, Peter, Gina, and Dan are off to this village. And the minute they pull into this village, and again, folks, you know, this is sort of a low-budget film. You know it's on a set. But, you know, I'll tell you what, folks, for what they had and what they had to work with, this was shot in an old movie studio called the Producer's Studio in Hollywood, and they did pretty good. I think the set work on this and stuff is pretty good. So I'm going to go with them. It's, you know, a grade up from TV, I would say. So I'm giving it, you know, some kudos on that. I think for what they had, they did pretty good. They pull into this old... this old village that these like descendants of the Mayans live in. They're not well received, and Raul all of a sudden disappears. They welcome him. They say, oh, Raul, you're back, and all that stuff. And then he just vanishes. And you know, something bad has happened there. And they are introduced to the chief of the village who, when he finds out they are looking for the Cave of the Dead, I mean, that's, you know, you just don't talk about those sort of things. You don't mess with that sort of thing. And he says, you'll have to talk to the doctor about that. And that's when they find out there's this Dr. Ramsey who's down there, lives just outside of the village. And they go out to his place. It's a little far out of this village. Now, compared to the way they're living, he's living in like a mansion, it almost seems like. Not a real mansion, but a mansion for someone who would be living in the jungle. It's pretty nice. And we find out that Ramsey, again, right from the beginning, he is a weird oddball type character. He claims, yeah, I sort of know about this cave that you're looking for and all that, but I got to tell you, you'd be better off not going there. I would recommend you not go there. We find out, because they end up staying with Ramsey for one night before they pursue the cave thing, that, you know, and they're concerned about Raul, too. They're trying to figure out where he's at. They're having dinner with him that night, and they find out during dinner that he's working on funguses, because he, when they first meet him, he's canning fruit, but he's not canning fruit to eat. These are the, it's sort of like the agar that the, or the agar, whatever you want to call it, that you can grow cultures in. That's what he's using the fruit for, to experiment with this fungus that he talks about. And he says, you know, and he explains to him, this is what I do. This is the research I am doing on this sort of thing. This is when we also meet Concha. And Concha accidentally goes to get some of the fruit because they want some fruit. And she drops one of the jars and it breaks on the floor. And just as Gina is reaching over to help her clean it up, Ramsey comes in and screams. He said, don't go near that. It'll kill you. And then we find out that he beats Concha for dropping the jar on the floor, which does not go over too well with the crowd down there. Well, they decide, you know, they're going to go find this cave. They're determined to find this cave. Lino, who we are introduced to now, is an assistant, an aide, but he's one of the Mayans who is helping Doc Ramsey. And he says, okay, he'll show you where the cave. It's going to cost you $200. You know, $200 to find out where the cave is, which they willingly pay because they want to find out where this gym guy is. They want to find out what's happened to him. Now, during the evening, there's a lot going on. Concha gets with Pete and with Dan and says, I want to take you to a place near here where you can hear the dead, where you'll hear the voices of the dead coming out from the ground. And she and you're hearing the drums in the background. You know, all kinds of ceremonies are going on. They're warned about some of the things that are happening. They get to this place, and you can hear it. You can hear groaning and suffering. And, of course, they're supposed to be near the place where the entrance to the Cave of the Dead is. And, you know, this goes right along with the legend of, you know, you have to go to purgatory and suffer before you can come back. Now, while this is going on, Gina has stayed behind. She has stayed at the house of Doc Ramsey's house. And this guy shows up, and there is something wrong with this guy. He's got stuff on him. You know, I mean, I can't even explain it. You assume it's some kind of disease or something. He chases her out into the jungle and is killed just as he's going in for the kill. Right? He's trying to get her, and he is killed before he has the opportunity to do that. And of course, Dan and Pete hear the screams and they come running and they get to Gina and find her out there and take her back to the house. So they're going to light out that next morning, and they do. Again, folks, I'm going to skip over the story a little bit. There's a little bit of a dragginess in some of these areas as they're getting set up to go. He's like, come on, get to the cave. And they get to the cave, and Lino shows them into the cave. They find an area where, they tell Lena to stay with the burros that's got all their supplies and stuff. But they find an area, and let me back up a little bit. Gina does not go with them this time. This is just Peter, Dan, and Lino. Now, Pete and Dan, they find this big cliff inside this cave. And again, I want to give some kudos to a lot of this is done on a set. That, you know, they didn't have Bronson Canyons or anything like that. So these are caves they manufactured. They're very claustrophobic. Charles did a really good job of making you feel like you're in a cave. Kudos to him on that. They find this deep cliff. They're not sure how far down it is, but dropping a torch, they realize it's about 200 feet, so they're able to get down there. They've got a rope ladder that'll get them down there. And they get looking, and they find Raul's body at the bottom of this cavern, along with the skeletons of a lot of other people. And now they realize, okay, you know, something about Raul and coming to the United States and all that, you know, he's been executed, whatever, sacrificed, that sort of thing. And they move on further in the cave. But before they can get much further, it starts flooding out on them. And Dan runs into some problems. He gets hurt, and he falls, and he has, you know, like a broken back or whatever. And Peter has no choice, but he says, I've got to go get some help. When he gets up to the entrance to the cave, Lino's gone. So he's gone with the burros, with the horses, everything. And Peter has to make it back on foot. And it takes him quite a while to get back to the house. Well, he gets back there with Gina. He tells her what's going on. And he says, we've got to go back. He says, we brought some diving gear. We're going to take that. And, you know, he doesn't want to take her, but she says, no, I'm not going to let you do this anymore. I mean, you by yourself, I've got to go with you. I've got to go help Dan. They get back there, and Lino does show up, and he goes, oh, I figured you were going to be a while, so I did this. It's just a really lame excuse. You know, And so you know something's going up here. You know Lena is up to no good. And he follows him down. They get into the lower regions of this cave. And then they find Dan. Now, Dan is in this little cubbyhole part area. It looks like his back is broken. He's seriously injured. And Pete's going to try to get him out. But Lino has some dynamite and ends up blowing the entrance entrance into this lower section, trapping them down there in the cave. But as there is some ironic justice, Lino was killed in a cave-in from the ramifications of that explosion. So you know, we knew Lino was up to no good. He was probably doing this at the behest of the chief in the village who didn't want anyone in the cave for whatever reason. And now, so you've got Gina and Peter, Dan with Dan, and Dan passes away. I mean, it was so serious. You knew he wasn't going to survive this. Now they've got to figure a way to get out of there. Well, Gina's staying with Dan while Peter says, I'm going to go look. I'm going to find a way out. And he finds this cavern that has these guys in it. I mean, they're all I can call them is fungus guys. They got fungus all over them. They look like the guy that chased Gina. Well, he manages to get away from them with the torch and all that stuff, and he finds this entrance up to the house. It's an underground entrance that leads to Doc Ramsey's house. He's beating on the door. Ramsey shows up, and he says, you know, I can't let you in. So Peter smashes the glass in the door, and of course, Ramsey goes nuts as Pete breaks in. He says, You're going to ruin everything. This stuff is going to spread because we see this stuff that's oozing off of the walls. This is the stuff that's gotten on the guys that are down there. And to make a long story short, we find out that Ramsey's not only been studying fungus, he has made this like super fungus, and he's been experimenting on the people in the village and throwing them into this cave to see the effects that this fungus has on them, and it's like a parasitic fungus. It kills them eventually, but it just totally takes them over. So now Pete, you know, is being confronted by Doc Ramsey here, and he's saying, we can't let this out. Now that we know that it won't be destroyed by fresh air, it could destroy the world. So they get Concha. Concha has some explosives. He tells him, we've got to set off the explosives to collapse this shaft to keep these guys in there. But before Concha gets a chance to do that, Pete grabs Ramsey and says, you're going to help me get my friend out. And he drags him back into the cave. And he tells Concha, he says, blow it up. Blow it up. And she blows it up and traps him in there. And Ramsey is killed by the collapse of the shaft and by the fungus. We see the fungus totally cover up his body. Now, folks, this is the one down part of this particular film, and that is the fungus looks like soap suds, and there's no way around it. Even in black and white, they couldn't quite make this work. If they could have found a way to make this look like Kaltiki or something like that, it would have been so much better. But the soap suds doesn't cut it. I've heard of movies using like oatmeal, like a little bit of watery oatmeal or something. That would have been so much better, but that's the only knock I'm going to give you on this movie. That hurt this movie a great deal. Pete gets back to Gina. They've got to find a way out. There's a waterway, or there's like a little stream there. A big stream. And he says, grab the diving gear. There's a good chance that this could lead out to the ocean. Which begs the question, if they're trying to stop this fungus from taking over the world, couldn't it get loose through there? I've always thought of that every time I've seen this. I think that's one little goof they made in the storyline. Yeah, they've collapsed in all of the shafts, but maybe it can't live in water. I don't know, whatever, but it would just seem like it might be able to escape that way. Well, they get it on the diving gear, and of course, now you're doing some cave diving. You can't really see very well, some of the most dangerous diving in the world. But Pete is able to see a shaft of life just as they're running out of air right to the very end. And it brings him up into another part of the cave that empties out onto the ocean. And we see them, get out of this stream and head out towards the ocean as the movie wraps up. Now, folks, I really spun through this a little fast, because there are some areas when they're doing the spelunking and the cave work and stuff, it can drag a little bit. You really want them to get to it. Some people think the payoff is a little weak. I wish they had done a little more development with that, with the people that were down there that were sort of these fungus people. I think they could have spent more time with that than the setup of them going through the cave trying to find this. Again, it's a minor criticism. It's a minor criticism. If you want to see sort of a novelty film from 1957, you can do a lot worse. It's a shame. I think they could have done a little better with this one. But it did get a pretty good release in the theaters in 57 because of the strength of being in a package with 20th Century Fox. But The Unknown Terror, I'm going to leave it to you folks to take a chance on it. I wouldn't go out and buy it too quickly. For a long time, this film was not available. It became available on home use, but an unauthorized version was released on VHS and eventually DVD. I think there's some authorized versions out there. I would sort of hold off on that and see if you could find this somewhere on a free service or whatever. There's a lot of free services online that are legitimate that'll let you watch movies, older movies on TV. They're in the public domain and that sort of thing. So I would do that first and just see what you think. But The Unknown Terror, I'm very ambivalent on it. I'm going to give it about a 2.5 star out of 5 star rating on this one. But it's an intriguing piece, and the actors do a fairly good job with the material that they're given. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again on Monday with another monster movie from my past here on Monster Attack. And we do appreciate all of the suggestions that you give us on the message board on our Facebook fan page. Keep the suggestions coming. So, also want to remind you to visit the Project Entertainment Network store. Now, I know, yes, I've been plugging that quite a bit, but let me tell you, there's a big sale going on this month. And it started on the 10th. And if you visit the Project Entertainment Network store, you're going to get 30% off on a lot of merchandise. So go up there. If you want some Monster Attack stuff, that's the place to go. Go to projectentertainmentnetwork.com. Click on the little store icon in the upper right-hand corner in that menu up there. And it'll take you to all the cool stuff that we have. Not only Monster Attack stuff, but stuff from all of our podcasts on Project Entertainment Network. And folks, we will see you next Monday on Monster Attack. Have a great week.
Every person's story has something to teach us. How others view life, how obstacles are overcome, how joy is felt, how fears are faced, how love is expressed. The Matters of Faith podcast explores individual stories of people's lives and how faith plays a part. It may not be your story, but it may help shape yours.
The Matters of Faith podcast with Jay Wilburn is on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.